and tell Richard to be quiet, and then she would start giggling again. They walked past Hunter without noticing her. She stepped out of the shadows and said, "You have been gone for 8 hours." It was a statement of fact without reproach or curiosity. Dor blinked at her.
"It didn't seem that long."
Hunter said nothing. Richard grinned blearily at her.
"Don't you want to know what happened? Well, we got ambushed by Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandemar. Unfortunately, we didn't have a bodyguard around. Still, I gave them a good seeing too."
Hunter raised a perfect eyebrow. "I am in awe of your pugilistic talents," she said coolly. Dor giggled.
"He's kidding. Actually, they killed us."
As an expert in the termination of bodily functions, Hunter said, "I must beg to differ. You are neither of you dead. At a guess, you were both very drunk." Dor stuck her tongue out at her bodyguard.
"Nonsense. Touched hardly a drop. That much."
She held out two fingers to show how tiny an amount "that much" was.
"Just went to a party," said Richard, "and saw Jessica, and saw a real angel, and got a little black piggy-wiggy, and came back here."
"Just a little drink,"
continued Dor intently.
Old drink. Tiny little drink. Very small. Almost not there."
She began to hiccup. Then she giggled again. A hiccup interrupted her, and she sat down suddenly on the platform.
"I think maybe we are a bit smashed," she said soberly.
Then she closed her eyes and began solemnly to snore. The Marquis de Carabas was running through the underways as if all the hounds of hell had his scent and were on his trail. He was splashing through 6 grey inches of the Tyburn. The Hangman's River, kept safe in the darkness in a brick sewer beneath Park Lane on its way south to Buckingham Palace. He had been running for 17 minutes. 30 feet below Marble Arch, he paused. The sewer divided into 2 branches. The Marquis de Carabas ran down the left-hand branch. Several minutes later, Mr. Vandemar walked through the sewer. And when he reached the junction, he, too, paused for a few moments, sniffing the air. And then he, too, walked down the left-hand branch. Hunter dropped Richard Mayhew's unconscious body into a pile of straw with a grunt. He rolled in the straw, said something that sounded like,
"Fothril the juggly mobile wug,"
and went back to sleep. She put Dor down in the straw next to him more gently. Then she stood beside Dor, in the dark stables under the ground, on guard still. The Marquis de Carabas was exhausted. He leaned against the tunnel wall and stared at the steps that went up ahead of him. Then he pulled out the golden pocket watch and looked at the time. 35 minutes had passed since he had fled the hospital cellar.
"Is it an hour yet?"
asked Mr. Vandemar. He was sitting on the steps ahead of the Marquis, picking his nails with a knife.
"Not even close," gasped the Marquis.
"Felt like an hour," said Mr. Vandemar, helpfully. There was a shiver in the world, and Mr. Krupp stood behind the Marquis de Carabas.
He still had powder on his chin. De Carabas stared at Mr. Krupp. He turned back to look at Mr. Vandemar, and then, spontaneously, the Marquis de Carabas began to laugh. Mr. Croup smiled.
"You find us funny, Monsieur Marquis. Do you not? A source of amusement, is that not so? With our pretty clothes and our convoluted circumlocutions."
Mr. Vandemar murmured, "I haven't got a circumlo."
"And our little sillinesses of manner and behaviour, and perhaps we are funny."
Mr. Croup raised one finger then and waggled it at de Carabas.
"But you must never imagine," he continued, "that just because something is funny, Monsieur Marquis, it is not dangerous."
And Mr. Vandemar threw his knife at the Marquis hard and accurately. It hit him, hilt first, on the temple. His eyes rolled up in his head, and his knees buckled.
"Circumlocution," said Mr. Croup to Mr. Vandemar. "It's a way of speaking around something, a digression, verbosity."
Mr. Vandemar picked up the Marquis de Carabas by his waistband and dragged him up the stairs, his head bump, bump, bumping on each step as they went. And Mr. Vandemar nodded.
"I wondered," he said.
Watching their dreams now, as they sleep. Hunter sleeps, standing up. In her dream, Hunter is in the undercity beneath Bangkok. It is partly a maze and partly a forest, for the wilderness of Thailand has retreated deep beneath the ground, under the airport and the hotels and the streets. The world smells of spice and dried mango, and it also smells, not unpleasantly, of sex. It is humid, and she is sweating. It is dark, broken by phosphorescent patches on the wall, greenish-grey funguses that give light enough to fool the eye, light enough to walk by. In her dream, Hunter moves silent as a ghost through the wet tunnels, pushing her way through vegetation. She holds a weighted throwing stick in her right hand. A leather shield covers her left forearm. She smells it in her dream, acrid and animal, and she pauses beside a wall of ruined masonry, and she waits, part of the shadows, one with the darkness. Hunting, like life, Hunter believes, consists chiefly of waiting. In Hunter's dream, however, she does not wait. Upon her arrival, it comes through the underbrush, a fury of brown and of white, undulating gently, like a wet-furred snake, its red eyes bright and peering through the darkness, its teeth like needles, a carnivore and a killer. The creature is extinct in the world above. It bears a similar relationship to the mink and to the weasel, to that which a timber wolf bears to a Yorkshire terrier. It weighs almost 300 pounds and is a little over 15 feet long from the tip of its nose to the tip of its tail. As it passes her, she hisses like a snake, and, momentarily, old instincts kicking in, it freezes, and then it leaps at her, nothing but hate and sharp teeth. She remembers then, in her dream, that this had happened before, and that when it had happened, that time in the past, she had pushed the leather arm shield into its mouth and crushed its skull with the leaden throwing stick, taking care not to damage the pelt. She had given the great weasel's pelt to a girl who had caught her eye, who had been appropriately grateful. But now, in her dream, that is not happening. Instead, the weasel is reaching out a forepaw toward her, and she is dropping her throwing stick and taking its paw. And then, and there, in the undercity beneath Bangkok, they are dancing together in one intricate, unending dance. And Hunter is watching them from outside herself, and she is admiring the elaborate movements they make as they move, tail and legs and arms and fingers and eyes and hair, all tumbling and twisting powerfully and strangely into the underneath and out across forever. There is a tiny noise in the waking world, a dreaming whimper from the child door, and Hunter moves from sleeping to waking fluidly and instantly. She is alert once more, and on guard. She forgets her dream entirely upon waking. Dor is dreaming of her father. In her dream, he is showing her how to open things. He picks up an orange and gestures. In one smooth movement, it inverts and twists. The orange flesh is on the outside now, and the skin is in the center on the inside. One must always maintain parity, her father tells her, peeling off an inside-out orange segment for her. Parity, symmetry, topology. These will be our subjects for the months to come, Dor. But the most important thing for you to understand is this. All things want to open. You must feel that need and use it. Her father's hair is brown and thick, as it was a decade before his death, and he has an easy smile, which she remembers, but which time has diminished as the years went on. In her dream, he passes her a padlock. She takes it from him. Her hands are the size and shape of her hands today, although she knows that, in truth, this occurred when she was a tiny child, that she is taking moments and conversations and lessons from over a dozen years and is compressing them into one lesson. Open it, he tells her. She holds it in her hand, feeling the cold metal, feeling the weight of the lock in her hands. Something is bothering her. There is something she has to know. Dor learned to open some time after she learned to walk. She remembers her mother holding her tightly, opening a door from Dor's bedroom to the playroom. Remembers watching her brother Arch separating linked silver rings, joining them back together. She tries to open the padlock. She fumbles at it with her fingers and with her mind. Nothing happens. She throws the padlock down onto the floor and begins to cry. Her father reaches down and picks up the padlock, puts it back into her hand. His long finger brushes away a tear from her cheek. Remember, he tells her, the padlock wants to open. All you have to do is let it do what it wants. It sits there in her hand, cold and inert and heavy. And then, suddenly, she understands. And somewhere in her heart, she lets it be what it wants to be. There is a loud click, and the padlock opens. Her father is smiling. There, she says. Good girl, says her father. That's all there is to opening. Everything else is just technique. She realizes what it is that is bothering her. Father, she asks, your journal. Who put it away? Who could have hidden it? But he is receding from her, and already she is forgetting. She calls to him, but he cannot hear her. And although she can hear his voice in the distance, she can no longer make out what he is saying. In the waking world, Dor whimpers softly. Then she rolls over, cradles her arm around her face, snorts once, twice, then sleeps once more. Sleeps without dreaming. Richard knows it waits for them. Each tunnel he goes down, each turning, each branch he walks, the feeling grows in urgency and weight. He knows it is there, waiting. And the sense of impending catastrophe increases with every step. He knows that it should have been a relief when he turns the final corner and sees it standing there, framed in the tunnel, waiting for him. Instead, he feels only dread. In his dream, it is the size of the world. There is nothing left in the world but the beast. Its flanks steaming, broken spars and juts of old weapons prickled from its hide. There is dried blood on its horns and on its tusks. It is gross and vast and evil. And then it charges. He raises his hand, but it isn't his hand. And he throws the spear at the creature. He sees its eyes, red and vicious and gloating as they float towards him, all in a fraction of a second that becomes a tiny forever. And then it is upon him. The water was cold, and it hit Richard's face like a slap. His eyes jerked open, and he caught his breath. Hunter was looking down at him. She was holding a large wooden bucket. It was empty. He reached up one hand. His hair was soaked and his face was wet. He wiped the water from his eyes and shivered with cold.
"You didn't have to do that," said Richard.
His mouth tasted like several small animals had been using it as a restroom before liquefying into something vaguely green. He tried to stand and then sat down again suddenly.
"Ooh,"
he explained. "How's your head?" asked Hunter, professionally. "It's been better," said Richard. Hunter picked up another wooden bucket, this one filled with water, and hauled it across the stable floor. "I don't know what you drank," she said, "but it must have been potent." Hunter dipped her hand into the bucket and flicked it at Dor's face, spraying her with water. Dor's eyes flickered.
"Oh, no wonder Atlantis sank," muttered Richard. "If they all felt like this in the morning, it was probably a relief. Where are we?"
Hunter flicked another handful of water at Dor's face.
"In the stables of a friend," she said.
Richard looked around. The place did look a little like a stable. He wondered if it were for horses. What kind of horses would live beneath the ground? There was a device painted on the wall, the letter S. Or was it a snake? Richard could not tell. Circled by seven stars. Dor reached a tentative hand up to her head and touched it experimentally, as if she were unsure just what she might find.
"Oh," she said in a near whisper. "Temple and arch. Am I dead?"
"No," said Hunter.
"Pity."
Hunter helped her to a standing position.
"Well," said Dor sleepily, "he did warn us it was strong."
And then Dor woke up completely, very hard, very fast. She grabbed Richard's shoulder, pointed to the device on the wall, the snaky S with the stars surrounding it. She gasped and looked for all the world like a small mouse that had just realized it had wandered into a cattery.
"Serpentine," she said to Richard, to Hunter. "That's Serpentine's crest. Richard, get up. We have to run before she finds out we're here."
"And do you think," asked a dry voice from the doorway, "that you could enter Serpentine's house without Serpentine knowing, child?" Dor pushed herself back against the wood of the stable wall. She was trembling. Richard realized, through the pounding in his head, that he had never seen Dor so actually and obviously scared before. Serpentine stood in the doorway. She was wearing a white leather corset and high white leather boots, and the remains of what looked like it had once, long ago, been a silk and lace confection of a white wedding dress, now shredded and dirt-stained and torn. She towered above them all. Her shock of graying hair brushed the door lintel. Her eyes were sharp, and her mouth was a cruel slash in an imperious face. She looked at Dor as if she took terror as her due, as if she had become so used to fear that she now expected it, even liked it.
"Calm yourself," said Hunter.
"But she's Serpentine,"
wailed Dor.
"Of the Seven Sisters."
Serpentine inclined her head cordially.
Then she stepped out of the doorway and walked toward them. Behind her was a thin woman with a severe face and long dark hair, wearing a black dress pinched wasp-thin at the waist. The woman said nothing. Serpentine walked over to Hunter.
"Hunter worked for me long ago," said Serpentine.
She reached out a white finger and gently stroked Hunter's brown cheek with it, a gesture of affection and possession. And then,
"You've kept your looks better than I, Hunter."
Hunter looked down.
"Her friends are my friends, child," said Serpentine. "You adore..."
"Yes," said Dor, dry-mouthed. Serpentine turned on Richard.
"And what are you?"
she asked, unimpressed. "Richard," said Richard.
"I am Serpentine," she told him, graciously.
"So I gathered," said Richard.
"There is food waiting for all of you," said Serpentine, "should you wish to break your fast."
"Oh, God, no," whimpered Richard politely. Dor said nothing. She was still backed against the wall, still trembling gently like a leaf in an autumn breeze. The fact that Hunter had clearly brought them here as a safe haven was doing nothing to assuage her fear.
"What is there to eat?" asked Hunter.
Serpentine looked at the wasp-waisted woman in the doorway.
"Well?"
she asked. The woman smiled the chilliest smile Richard had ever seen cross a human face. Then she said,
"Fried eggs, poached eggs, pickled eggs, curried venison, pickled onions, pickled herrings, smoked herrings, salted herrings, mushroom stew, salted bacon, stuffed cabbage, mutton hot pot, calf's foot jelly."
Richard opened his mouth to plead with her to stop, but it was too late. He was suddenly, violently, awfully sick. He wanted someone to hold him, to tell him that everything would be all right, that he'd soon be feeling better. Someone to give him an aspirin and a glass of water and show him back to his bed. But nobody did, and his bed was another life away. He washed the sick from his face and hands with water from the bucket. Then he washed out his mouth. Then, swaying gently, he followed the four women to breakfast.
"Pass the calf's foot jelly," said Hunter, with her mouth full.
Serpentine's dining room was on what appeared to be the smallest underground platform that Richard had ever seen. It was about 12 feet long, and much of that space was taken up with the dinner table. A white damask cloth was laid on the table, and a former silver dinner service on that. The table was piled high with evil-smelling foodstuffs. "The pickled quail's eggs," thought Richard, "smelled the worst." His skin felt clammy, and his eyes felt like they had been put in wrong, while his skull gave him the general impression that someone had removed it while he had slept and swapped it for one, two or three sizes too small. An underground train went past a few feet from them. The wind of its passage whipped at the table. The noise of its passage went through Richard's head like a hot knife through brains. Richard groaned.
"Your hero is unable to hold his wine, I see," observed Serpentine, dispassionately.
"He's not my hero," said Dor.
"I'm afraid he is. You learn to recognize the type. Something in the eyes, perhaps."
She turned to the woman in black, who appeared to be some kind of majordomo.
"A restorative for the gentleman."
The woman smiled thinly and glided away. Dor picked at a mushroom dish. "We are very grateful for all this, Lady Serpentine," she said. Serpentine sniffed.
"Just Serpentine, child. I have no time for silly honorifics and imaginary titles."
"So," You're Portico's oldest girl.
Yes.
Serpentine dipped her finger in the briny sauce that held what appeared to be several small eels. She licked her finger, nodded approvingly.
I had little time for your father. All that foolishness about uniting the underside. Stuff and nonsense.
Silly man, just asking for trouble.
The last time I saw your father, I told him that if he ever came back here, I'd turn him into a blind worm.
She turned to Dor.
How is your father, by the way?
He's dead, said Dor.
Serpentine looked perfectly satisfied.
See, she said. My point exactly.
Dor said nothing. Serpentine picked at something that was moving in her grey hair. She examined it minutely, then crushed it between finger and thumb and dropped it onto the platform. Then she turned to Hunter, who was demolishing a small hill of pickled herrings.
"You're beast hunting, then,"
she said. Hunter nodded, her mouth full.
"You'll need the spear, of course," said Serpentine.
The wasp-waisted woman was now standing next to Richard, holding a small tray. On the tray was a small glass, containing an aggressively emerald-coloured liquid. Richard stared at it, then looked at Dor.
"What are you giving him?" asked Dor.
"Nothing that will hurt him," said Serpentine, with a frosty smile. "You are guests."
Richard knocked back the green liquid, which tasted of thyme and peppermint and winter's mornings. He felt it go down, and prepared himself to try to stop it coming back up again. Instead, he took a deep breath and realized, with a little surprise, that his head no longer hurt, and that he was starving.
Old Bailey was not, intrinsically, one of those people put in the world to tell jokes. Despite this handicap, he persisted in telling jokes. Inordinate length, which would end in a sad pun, although often as not, Old Bailey would be unable to remember it by the time he got there.
The only public for Old Bailey's jokes consisted of a small captive audience of birds, who, particularly the rooks, viewed his jokes as deep and philosophical parables containing some deep and penetrating insights into what it meant to be human, and who would actually ask him, from time to time, to tell them another of his amusing stories.
"All right, all right, all right," Old Bailey was saying. "Stop me if you've heard this one before. There was a man walked into a bar." "No, he wasn't a man. That's a joke. Sorry, he was a horse. A horse, no. A piece of string. Three pieces of string. Right. Three pieces of string walk into a bar."
A huge old rook croaked a question. Old Bailey rubbed his chin, then shrugged.
They just do. It's a joke. They can walk in the joke. He asks for a drink for himself and one for each of his friends. And the barman says, "We don't serve pieces of string here." To one of the pieces of string. So, it goes back to its friends and says, "They don't serve strings here." And it's a joke. So the middle one does it too. Three of them, you see. Then the last one, he ties himself around the middle. And he pulls the end of him all out. And he orders a drink.
The rook croaked again. Sagely.
Three drinks, right. And the barman says, "Here, aren't you one of those pieces of string?" And he says, the piece of string, he says, "No, I'm a frayed knot." A frayed knot, you see. A frayed knot. Pun. Very, very funny.
The starlings made polite noises. The rooks nodded their heads, put their heads on one side. Then the oldest rook cawed at Old Bailey.
"Another?
I'm not made of hilarity, you know. Oh, let me think.
There was a noise from the tent, a deep, pulsing noise, like the beating of a distant heart. Old Bailey hurried into his tent. The noise was coming from an old wooden chest in which Old Bailey kept those things he prized. He opened the chest. The throbbing noise became much, much louder. The small silver box was sitting on the top of Old Bailey's treasures. He reached down one gnarly hand and picked it up. A red light rhythmically pulsed and glowed inside it like a heartbeat and shone out through the silver filigree and through the cracks and fastenings.
"He's in trouble," said Old Bailey.
The oldest rook cawed a question.
"No, it's not a joke. It's the Marquis," said Old Bailey. "He's in deep trouble."
Richard was halfway through his second plate of breakfast when Serpentine pushed her chair back from the table.
"I think I have had my fill of hospitality," she said. "Child, young man, good day. Hunter."
She paused. Then she ran one claw-like finger along the line of Hunter's jaw.
"Hunter, you are always welcome here."
She nodded to them imperiously and stood up and walked away, followed by her wasp-waisted butler.
"We should leave now," said Hunter.
She stood up from the table, and Dor and, more reluctantly, Richard followed her. They walked along a corridor that was too thin to allow more than one of them to pass at a time. They went up some stone steps. They crossed an iron bridge in the darkness, while underground trains echoed by beneath them. Then they entered what seemed like an endless network of underground vaults that smelled of damp and decay, of brick and stone and time.
"That was your old boss, eh?"
"Oh, she seemed nice enough," said Richard to Hunter. Hunter said nothing. Dor, who had been somewhat subdued, said, "When they want to make children behave themselves in the underside, they tell them, 'Behave, or Serpentine will take you.'"
"Oh," said Richard. "And you worked for her, Hunter?"
"I worked for all the Seven Sisters."
"I thought that they hadn't spoken to each other for, oh, at least 30 years, said Dor.
"Quite possibly, but they were still talking then."
"How old are you?" asked Dor.
Richard was pleased she had asked. He would never have dared.
"As old as my tongue," said Hunter primly, "and a little older than my teeth." "Anyway," said Richard, in the untroubled tone of voice of one whose hangover has left him and who knew that, somewhere far above them, someone was having a beautiful day. "That was okay. Nice food, and no one was trying to kill us."
"I'm sure that will remedy itself as the day goes on," said Hunter, accurately. "Which way to the Blackfriars, my lady?" Dor paused and concentrated.
"We'll go the river way," she said. "Over here." "Is he coming round yet?" asked Mr. Croup.
Mr. Vandemar prodded the Marquis's prone body with one long finger. The breathing was shallow.
"Not yet, Mr. Croup. I think I broke him." "You must be more careful with your toys, Mr. Vandemar," said Mr. Croup.
Chapter 11.
"So what are you after?" Richard asked Hunter.
The three of them were walking with extreme care along the bank of an underground river. The bank was slippery, a narrow path along dark rock and sharp masonry. Richard watched with respect as the grey water rushed and tumbled within arm's reach. This was not the kind of river you fell into and got out of again. It was the other kind.
"After?" "Well,"
he said. Personally, I'm trying to get back to the real London and my old life. Dor wants to find out who killed her family. What are you after? They edged along the bank, a step at a time, Hunter in the lead. She said nothing in reply. The river slowed and fed into a small underground lake. They walked beside the water, their lamps reflecting in the black surface, their reflections smudged by the river mist. "So what is it?" asked Richard. He did not expect any kind of answer. Hunter's voice was quiet and intense. She did not break her step as she spoke. "I fought in the sewers beneath New York with the great blind white alligator king. He was 30 feet long, fat from sewage, and fierce in battle. And I bested him, and I killed him. His eyes were like huge pearls in the darkness." Her strangely accented voice echoed in the underground, twined in the mist in the night beneath the earth. "I fought the bear that stalked the city beneath Berlin. He had killed 1,000 men, and his claws were stained brown and black from the dried blood of 100 years. But he fell to me. He whispered words in a human tongue as he died." The mist hung low on the lake. Richard fancied that he could see the creatures she spoke of, white shapes writhing in the vapor. "There was a black tiger in the undercity of Calcutta, a man-eater, brilliant and bitter, the size of a small elephant. A tiger is a worthy adversary. I took him with my bare hands." Richard glanced at Dor. She was listening to Hunter intently. This was news to her too, then. "And I shall slay the beast of London. They say his hide bristles with swords and spears and knives stuck in him by those who have tried and failed. His tusks are razors, and his hooves are thunderbolts. I will kill him, or I will die in the attempt." Her eyes shone as she spoke of her prey. The river mist had become a thick yellow fog. A bell was struck, a little way away, 3 times, the sound carrying across the water. The world began to lighten. Richard thought he could see the squat shapes of buildings around them. The yellow-green fog became thicker. It tasted of ash and soot and the grime of 1,000 urban years. It clung to their lamps, muffling the light. "What is this?" he asked. "London fog," said Hunter. "But they stopped years ago, didn't they? Clean Air Act, all that." Richard found himself remembering the Sherlock Holmes books of his childhood. What did they call them again? "Pea soupers," said Dor. "London particulars. Thick yellow river fogs mixed with coal smoke and whatever rubbish was going into the air for the last 5 centuries. Hasn't been one in the upworld for, 40 years now. We get the ghosts of them down here." "Not ghosts. More like echoes." Richard breathed in a strand of the yellow-green fog and began to cough. "That doesn't sound good," said Dor. "Fog in my throat," said Richard. The ground was becoming stickier, muddier. It sucked at Richard's feet as he walked. "Still," he said, to reassure himself, "a little fog never hurt anyone." Dor looked up at him with big pixie eyes. "There was one in 1952 that they reckon killed 4,000 people. "People from here?" he asked. "Under London?" "Your people," said Hunter. Richard was willing to believe it. He thought about holding his breath, but the fog was getting thicker. The ground was becoming mushier. "I don't understand," he asked. "Why do you have fogs down here when we don't have them up there anymore?" Dor scratched her nose. There are little bubbles of old time in London where things and places stay the same, like bubbles in amber, she explained. There's a lot of time in London, and it has to go somewhere. It doesn't all get used up at once. I may still be hungover, sighed Richard. That almost made sense. The abbot had known that this day would bring pilgrims. The knowledge was a part of his dreams. It surrounded him, like the darkness. So the day became one of waiting, which was, he knew, a sin. Moments were to be experienced. Waiting was a sin against both the time that was still to come and against the moments one was currently disregarding. Still, he was waiting. Through each of the day's services, through their scant meals, the abbot was listening intently, waiting for the bell to sound, waiting to know who and how many. He found himself hoping for a clean death. The last pilgrim had lasted for almost a year, a gibbering, screaming thing. The abbot regarded his blindness neither as a blessing nor as a curse. It simply was. But even so, he had been grateful he had never been able to see the poor creature's face. Brother Jet, who had cared for the creature, still woke in the night, screaming, with its twisted face before him. The bell tolled late in the afternoon, three times. The abbot was in the shrine, on his knees, contemplating their charge. He pulled himself to his feet and made his way to the corridor, where he waited. Father? The voice was that of Brother Fuliginus. Who guards the bridge? The abbot asked him. His voice was surprisingly deep and melodious for such an old man. Sable, came the reply from the darkness. The abbot reached out a hand, grasped the young man's elbow, and walked beside him, slowly, through the corridors of the abbey. There was no solid ground. There was no lake. Their feet were splashing and squishing through some kind of marsh in the yellow fog. This, announced Richard, is disgusting. It was seeping through his shoes, invading his socks and making a much closer acquaintance with his toes than Richard was entirely happy with. There was a bridge ahead of them, rising up out of the marsh, and a figure dressed in black waited at the foot of the bridge. He wore the black robes of a Dominican monk. His skin was the dark brown of old mahogany. He was a tall man, and he held a wooden staff as tall as he was. "Hold fast," he called. "Tell me your names and your stations." "I am the Lady Dor," said Dor. "I am Portico's daughter of the House of the Arch. I am Hunter. I am her bodyguard." "Richard Mayhew," said Richard. "Wet. And you wish to pass?" Richard stepped forward. "Yes, we do, actually. We're here for a key." The monk said nothing. He lifted his staff and pushed Richard gently in the chest with it. Richard's feet slid out from under him and he landed in the muddy water, or to be fractionally more accurate, the watery mud. The monk waited a few moments to see if Richard would swing up and begin to fight. Richard didn't. Hunter did. Richard pulled himself up from the mud and, mouth open, watched his first quarterstaff fight. The monk was good. He was bigger than Hunter and, Richard suspected, stronger. Hunter, on the other hand, was faster than the monk. The wooden staves clacked and whacked in the mist. The monk's staff made sudden contact with Hunter's midriff. She stumbled in the mud. He came in close, too close, as he discovered that her stumble had been a feint, and her staff slammed into him hard and precisely on the backs of his knees, and his legs no longer held his weight. The man tumbled into the wet mud, and Hunter rested the tip of her staff on the back of his neck. "Enough," called a voice from the bridge. Hunter took a step back. She stood beside Richard and Dor once more. She had not even broken a sweat. The big monk got up from the mud His lip was bleeding. He bowed low to Hunter, then walked to the foot of the bridge.
"Who are they, Brother Sable?" called the voice. "The Lady Dor, Lord Portico's daughter of the House of the Arch, Hunter, her bodyguard, and Richard Mayhew Wett, their companion," said Brother Sable, through bruised lips. "She bested me in fair fight, Brother Fuliginus." "Let them come up," said the voice.
Hunter led the way up the bridge. At the apex of the bridge, another monk was waiting for them. Brother Fuliginus. He was younger and smaller than the first monk they had met, but he was dressed the same way. His skin was a deep, rich brown. There were other black-clad figures just on the borders of the visible, further into the yellow fog. These were the Black Friars, then, Richard realized. The second monk stared at the three of them for a second, and then recited, "I turn my head, and you may go where you want. I turn it again, you will stay till you rot. I have no face, but I live or die by my crooked teeth. Who am I?" Dor took a step forward. She licked her lips and half-closed her eyes. "I turn my head," she said, puzzling to herself. "Crooked teeth, go where you..." Then a smile spread over her face. She stared up at Brother Fuliginus. "A key," she said. "The answer is, you're a key."
"A wise one," acknowledged Brother Fuliginus. "That's two steps taken. One more to take."
A very old man stepped out of the yellow fog and walked cautiously towards them, his gnarled hand holding onto the stone side of the bridge. He stopped when he reached Brother Fuliginus. His eyes were a glaucous blue-white, thick with cataracts. Richard liked him on sight.
"How many of them are there?"
he asked the younger man in a deep and reassuring voice.
"Three, Father Abbot." "And has one of them bested the first gatekeeper?"
"Yes, Father Abbot."
"And did one of them answer the second gatekeeper correctly?"
"Yes, Father Abbot."
There was regret in the old man's voice.
"So, one of them is left to face the ordeal of the key. Let him or her stand forward now."
Dor said,
"Oh, no."
Hunter said, "Let me take his place. I will face the ordeal." Brother Fuliginus shook his head. "We cannot permit that." When Richard was a small boy, he had been taken as part of a school trip to a local castle. With his class, he had climbed the many steps to the highest point in the castle, a partly ruined tower. They had clustered together at the top, while the teacher pointed out to them the whole of the countryside spread out below. Even at that age, Richard had not been very good at heights. He had clutched the safety rail and screwed up his eyes and tried not to look down. The teacher had told them that the drop from the top of the old tower to the bottom of the hill it overlooked was 300 feet. Then she told them that a penny dropped from the top of the tower would have enough force to penetrate the skull of a man at the bottom of the hill, that it would crack a skull like a bullet. That night, Richard lay in bed, unable to sleep for imagining the penny falling with the power of a thunderbolt, still looking like a penny, but such a murderous penny when it dropped. An ordeal. The penny dropped for Richard. It was a thunderbolt, sort of a penny.
"Hang on a sec," he said. "Back up. Ordeal. Someone's got an ordeal waiting for them. Somebody who didn't have a little fight down in the mud and didn't get to answer the little riddle."
He was babbling. He could hear himself babbling, and he just didn't care.
"At this ordeal of yours,"
Richard asked the abbot. How much of an ordeal is it? Is this the kind of ordeal like going to visit a rather ill-tempered elderly female relative is an ordeal? Or is this kind of ordeal more like a plunging your hand into scalding water to see how fast it takes off the skin sort of ordeal?
This way now, said the abbot.
You don't want him, said Dor. Take one of us.
Three of you come. There are three tests. Each of you faces one test. That is fair, said the abbot. If he passes the ordeal, he will return to you.
A light breeze eased the fog. The other dark figures were holding crossbows. Each crossbow was pointed at Richard or Hunter or Dor. The friars closed ranks, cutting Richard off from Hunter and from Dor.
We're looking for a key, said Richard to the abbot, in a low voice.
Yes, said the abbot placidly.
It's for an angel, explained Richard.
Yes, said the abbot. He reached out a hand, found the crook of Brother Fuliginus's arm.
Richard lowered his voice.
Look, you can't say no to an angel, especially a man of the cloth like yourself. Why don't we just skip the ordeal bit? If you could just hand it over, I can tell them we ordealed.
The abbot began to walk down the curve of the bridge. There was a door open at the bottom. Richard followed him. Sometimes there is nothing you can do.
When our order was founded, said the abbot, we were entrusted with the key. It is one of the holiest and the most powerful of all sacred relics. We must pass it on, but only to the one who passes the ordeal and proves worthy.
They walked through winding narrow corridors, Richard leaving a trail of wet mud behind him.
If I fail the ordeal, then we don't get the key, do we?
No, my son.
Richard thought about this for a moment.
Could I come back later for a second go?
Brother Fuliginus coughed.
Not really, my son, said the abbot. If that should happen, you will in all probability be...
He paused and then said,
beyond caring. But do not fret, perhaps you will be the one to win the key, eh?
There was a ghastly attempt at reassurance in his voice, which was more terrifying than any kind of attempt to scare could have been.
You would kill me?
The abbot stared ahead with blue milk eyes. There was a touch of reproof in his voice.
We are holy men, he said. No, it is the ordeal that kills you.
They walked down a flight of steps into a low crypt-like room with oddly decorated walls.
Now, said the abbot.
Smile!
There was the electric fizz of a camera flash going off, blinding Richard for a moment. When he could see again, Brother Fuliginus had lowered a battered old Polaroid camera and was yanking out the photograph. The friar waited until it had developed, and then he pinned it to the wall.
This is our wall of those who failed, sighed the abbot, to ensure that they are none of them forgotten. That is our burden also. Memorial.
Richard stared at the faces. A few Polaroids, 20 or 30 other photographic snapshots, some sepia prints and daguerreotypes, and after that, pencil sketches and watercolors and miniatures. They went all the way along one wall. The friars had been at this a very long time. Dor shivered.
I'm so stupid, she muttered. I should have known, three of us. I should never have come straight here.
Hunter's head was moving from side to side. She had noted the position of each of the friars and each of the crossbows. She had calculated the odds of getting Dor over the side of the bridge first unharmed, then with only minor injuries, and lastly, with major injury to herself, but only minor injury to Dor. She was now recalculating.
And what would you have done differently if you had known? She asked.
I wouldn't have brought him here for a start, said Dor.
I'd have found the Marquis. Hunter put her head on one side. You trust him? She asked directly. And Dor knew she was talking of Decarabus, not Richard.
Yes, said Dor. I more or less trust him.
Dor had been 5 years old for just 2 days. The market was being held in the gardens at Kew on that day, and her father had taken her with him as a birthday treat. It was her first market. They were in the butterfly house, surrounded by brightly colored wings, iridescent, weightless things that entranced and fascinated her, when her father crouched down beside her. Dor, he said, turn around slowly and look over there, by the door. She turned and looked. A dark-skinned man, wearing a big coat, his black hair tied behind him in a long ponytail, was standing by the door, talking to two golden-skinned twins, a young man and a young woman. The young woman was crying, in the way that grown-ups cry, keeping it inside as much as they can, and hating it when it still pushes out at the edges, making them ugly and funny-looking on the way. Dor turned back to the butterflies. "You saw him?" asked her father. She nodded. "He calls himself the Marquis de Carabas," he said. "He's a fraud and a cheat and possibly even something of a monster. If you're ever in trouble, go to him. He will protect you, girl. He has to." Dor looked back at the man. He had a hand on the shoulder of each of the twins and was leading them from the room. But he glanced back over his shoulder as he left, and he looked straight at her and smiled an enormous smile. And then he winked at her. The friars who surrounded them were dark ghosts in the fog. Dor raised her voice.
"Excuse me, brother," she called to Brother Sable, "but our friend who's gone to get the key, if he fails, what happens to us?"
He took a step towards them, hesitated, and then said, "We escort you away from here. And we let you go."
"What about Richard?" she asked.
Beneath his cowl, she could see him shaking his head, sadly, finally.
"I should have brought the Marquis," said Dor, and she wondered where he was and what he was doing.
The Marquis de Carabas was being crucified on a large X-shaped wooden construction Mr. Vandemar had knocked together from several old pallets, part of a chair, a wooden gate, and something that appeared to be a cartwheel. He had also used most of a large box of rusting nails. Mr. Croup had supervised the construction and made useful suggestions, between scavenging about the hospital, looking for useful implements. Now Mr. Vandemar was up a ladder, hauling the whole construction around, Marquis and all.
"A little bit up," called Mr. Croup,
who was down at ground level.
"Little to the left. Yes, that'll do it lovely."
It had been a very long time since they had crucified anybody. The Marquis de Carabas's arms and legs were spread into a wide X shape. Nails went into his hands and feet. He was also roped around the waist. He was, to all intents and purposes, unconscious. The whole construction dangled in the air from several ropes in a room that had once been the hospital staff cafeteria. On the ground below, Mr. Croup had assembled a large mound of sharp objects, ranging from razors and kitchen knives to abandoned scalpels and lancets, and a number of interesting things Mr. Vandemar had found in the former dental wing. There was even a poker from the furnace room.
"Why don't you see how he's doing, Mr. Vandemar?" asked Mr. Croup.
Mr. Vandemar reached out his hammer and prodded the Marquis experimentally with it. The Marquis de Carabas was not a good man, and he knew himself well enough to be perfectly certain that he was not a brave man. He had long since decided that the world above or below, was a place that wished to be deceived, and to this end he had named himself from a lie in a fairy tale, and created himself